The title of today's lecture is West and the Wind Blowing. There's a letter by Saint John Perse, headed Washington, 23rd December 1941, which begins like this. Mon cher Archer, je n'aurais pu tous ces temps-ci vous parler de rien de littéraire. J'ai vécu trop fraternellement ces premières années de guerre que vous vivez et qui accroissent encore sur vos épaules un fardeau déjà lourd. Vous savez qu'auprès de mon cœur de Français libre, il y aura toujours en moi un cœur qui bat américain. The recipient of this letter, the Archie to which it was addressed, was the American poet Archibald MacLeish. And the friendship between the two men, Saint John Perse and Archibald MacLeish, was probably one of the finest in the history of modern literature. It was Archibald MacLeish who obtained for Saint John Perse in exile a post at the Library of Congress. It was he who was largely instrumental in Perse's obtaining the American Academy's Quinquennial Prize for Poetry. And it was MacLeish again who encouraged Harvard to offer Perse the Charles Eliot Norton Chair in Poetry. Archibald MacLeish was born 1892 in Glencoe, Illinois, of Scottish and New England parents. 1915, he took a BA at Yale University. 1917, he was in France in an ambulance unit, then in the field artillery. And it was in that same year, 1917, that his first book, The Tower of Ivory, appeared. 1919, he was back in the States, where he took an LLB, a Bachelor of Laws, at Harvard. He taught for a year at Harvard University, and then practiced law in Boston for 3 years, from 1920 to 1923. In that year, 1923, he went to Paris, and he stayed there for 5 years till 1928, saying, so important was this experience for him, that I date the beginning of my life from 1923. In an autobiographical poem, The Years of the Dog, he describes in the following lines his experiences, his life in Paris. Before, though, Paris was wonderful. Wanderers talking in all tongues, from every country. In Paris, he frequented other Americans in exile, like Dos Passos, Cummings, Fitzgerald, Thornton Wilder, James Joyce, and among the Irish. And he was reading Pound and Eliot, Rimbaud, La Fogue, also Chinese Tang poets, Li Po, Tu Fu, Po Chui, also William Butler Yeats, and Dante. And it was during those years that his poems began to appear, some of them in Eliot's magazine, The Criterion, and some of them in the French magazine, Commerce. 1924, a book of short lyrics appears, The Happy Marriage. 1926, another book of short poems, Streets in the Moon. But during that Paris period, there were also two long poems, a genre in which Archibald MacLeish is going to continue to work, 1926, The Pot of Earth, and in that same year, The Hamlet of Archibald MacLeish. 1928, he went back to the United States, where he settled on a farm. 1929, a relatively long poem, Einstein. 1929, that same year, he went down to Mexico on his own, where he studied Cortes' route in order to write a long poem which came out in 1932, Conquistador, part of his American preoccupations, which had already begun to express themselves in 1930 with the poem New Found Land. This poem, Conquistador, obtained the Pulitzer Prize when it came out in 1932. 1933, Frescoes for Mr. Rockefeller's City. That same year, Elpenor. 1936, he's engaged in and preoccupied with the Spanish Civil War, where he works for the Loyalist cause in Spain. And in that same year, 1936, he publishes Public Speech. 1939, he's appointed Librarian of Congress. And in that same year, 1939, he brings out the poem, the book, America Was Promises. 1941-42, he's Director of the Office of Facts and Figures. 42-43, he's Assistant Director of the Office of War Information. 1943, another book appears, Colloquy for the States. 1944-45, he's Assistant Secretary of State. So alongside his political activity, there is this socio-political activity. He's also, in that same year, one of the planners of UNESCO. 1948, Act 5 and other poems. 1949, he occupies the Boylston Professorship of Rhetoric at Harvard, which he retains until 1962. 1950, a book of essays appears, one of his several books of essays, Poetry and Opinion. 1952, the collected poems appears, and he obtains a second Pulitzer Prize. 1960, another book of essays, Poetry and Experience. 1968, another book of essays, A Continuing Journey. He dies a few years later, one of his later books being entitled directly from W.B. Yeats, The Wild Old Wicked Man and Other Poems. A phrase from an early poem of MacLeish's has had almost as large a fortune in poetics as a later phrase by William Carlos Williams, No Ideas But in Things. The phrase by Archibald MacLeish is this: a poem should not mean but be. A poem should not mean but be. Before commenting on it, let me read the poem in which it occurs. It's entitled Ars Poetica. A poem should be palpable and mute as a globed fruit, dumb as old medallions to the thumb, silent as the sleeve-worn stone of casement ledges where the moss has grown. A poem should be wordless as the flight of birds. A poem should be motionless in time as the moon climbs, leaving as the moon releases twig by twig the night-entangled trees, leaving as the moon behind the winter leaves, memory by memory, the mind. A poem should be equal to, not true, for all the history of grief, an empty doorway and a maple leaf, for love, the leaning grasses, and two lights above the sea. A poem should not mean, but be. Before this poem is taken as a plea for some kind of l'art pour l'art, some kind of art for art's sake, let's look a little closer at that dialectic being-meaning. MacLeish is by no means in this poem, or anywhere else in his work, recommending meaninglessness. This poem is not a plea for lack of meaning. He speaks in one of his books of essays, Riders on the Earth, of the contemporary cult of meaninglessness, which he intends, as he always had, to react against. Though in this poem he's speaking rather of the special way that meaning comes across in a poem. In one of his essays, The Use of Poetry and the Use of Criticism, which was published in 1933, T.S. Eliot says this concerning meaning: the seasoned reader, he who has reached a state of greater purity, does not bother about understanding a poem, not at least at first. The chief use of the meaning of a poem, and he puts the word in inverted commas, the chief use of the meaning of a poem may be to keep the reader's mind diverted and quiet while the poem does its work upon him, the meaning being like the meat the proverbial burglar keeps for the dog. What Eliot is suggesting that is that the elimination of obvious meaning may offer the opportunity for possibilities of density and intensity. As we saw in the quick autobiographical run-through, Archibald MacLeish was, for a time, a lawyer. And he says this of lawyers: lawyers use words as signs standing for meanings, whereas poets, In other words, poets have a different attitude to words and to meanings. Words for the poet are, in addition to meaning, sound, image, metaphor. And for Archibald MacLeish, images are a means to meaning. Images and the relationship between images. This is something that comes across in Baudelaire's L'imagination du poète est la plus scientifique des facultés parce que seule elle comprend l'analogie universelle. Baudelaire's theory is behind this poetics, this aesthetics of Archibald MacLeish. Coleridge also, Baudelaire and Coleridge. Coleridge, in his Biographia Literaria, says the poet brings the whole soul of man into activity. Not only a specific meaning, but the whole soul of man into activity. You might say the whole being into activity. And for Coleridge, imagination is a synthetic power, a more than usual state of emotion with more than usual order. We're beyond any simplistic sense of monolinear meaning. Archibald MacLeish goes so far as to speak of meaning in a poem as the feel of meaning or the shape of meaning, not something that can simply be translated into easy terms. If the world of immediate experience can be captured, he says, can be held still, can be made visible, sensible, in and as itself, it will mean. If the world, I repeat, if the world of immediate experience can be captured, can be held still, can be made visible, sensible, in and as itself, it will mean. In other words, the poem is not so much presenting a meaning as offering the presence of a world, offering an invitation to inhabit a complete world. The poem is not simply a piece of literature, a piece of art for art's sake. It is, and here I quote MacLeish, creative action in time and space, working out a subtle relationship between self and world. The poem then is not simply a word artifact, but a world act, moving towards, sometimes realizing immediately, or moving towards a new type of organization. And this type of organization of the human mind, of the human mind's relationship with the world, and of that human world itself, seemed to MacLeish something absolutely essential, and which was being lost in modern society, which tended to be more science-orientated. He says, with regard to the science orientation, man lost himself in the external universe. It was divided into a million external events. And the common inner life, of the common inner life, only the simplest emotions remained. So that poetry suffered, poetry was limited, became limited to these simple emotions, whereas poetry potentially, essentially you might say, is concerned with this relationship to the world, with an enlarged sense of inhabitation of the world. And for MacLeish, poetic activity today should mean something like, shall we say, re-entering the world. And poetry is not simply talking about this re-entering the world. It doesn't simply mean re-entering the world. It tries to offer the actual experience of entering the world. Let's say that poetry is concerned less with communication than with experience. So much for this early poem, insisting on the fact that far from merely desiring to produce a collection of arty bits and pieces to be aesthetically contemplated and enjoyed, MacLeish is concerned with a vast enterprise to be vehicled by a whole work. Not simply one poem after another, but the move to a world poem. And Saint-Jean-Perse, to come back to him, was very much aware of this. In a letter dated 14th May 1958, Saint John Perse says this, writing to MacLeish, "Vous relevez enfin cette notion d'œuvre que l'on a trop tendance à déserter parmi l'émiettement littéraire. Vous relevez enfin cette notion d'œuvre que l'on a trop tendance à déserter parmi l'émiettement littéraire." Archibald MacLeish is after a magnum opus, shall we say, and we can be even more specific, he's after a magnum opus Americanum. America is very much at the center of MacLeish's preoccupations, his world preoccupations. He uses, again and again, the expression, the well-known expression, the American dream. Now, if American dream has become all too flat a term and has been used too indiscriminately, let's say, in place of American dream, American vision, or perhaps even better, American movement. And this notion of American movement, this awareness of a specifically American thing, is presented again, very beautifully, I think, by Saint John Perse in a letter, Un Journaliste Américain, dated April 1950. Saint John Perse says this concerning American literature, meaning American poetry. J'aime et j'admire la littérature américaine dans son évolution proprement américaine. Une libre et forte évolution créatrice qui tend à dégager, comme la ruée d'un fleuve s'ouvrant lui-même son lit, un cours imprévisible de valeurs nouvelles. C'est le Colorado taillant résolument sa voie vers le golfe de Californie. Beautiful image for American poetry, American poetics. C'est le Colorado taillant résolument sa voie vers le golfe de Californie. But in that same letter, Perse also speaks of the difficulties of poetry in America, the difficulty of the poet in the U.S. situation. And his letter continues, il faut d'autant plus déplorer les conditions humaines faites aux littérateurs américains. Conditions difficiles, particulièrement difficiles, et qui peuvent arrêter en germe l'éclosion des plus beaux dons, ou limiter même, en cours de route, l'épanouissement des meilleures vocations. J'entends des plus désintéressés. Je ne pense pas tant aux difficultés matérielles qui sont les mêmes en tout pays. Je pense surtout aux conditions morales particulières à ce pays. Je pense à la dispersion intellectuelle d'un si vaste pays, à l'automatisme industriel où il entraîne la charge croissante de ses responsabilités techniques sous une charge croissante de responsabilités politiques. La solitude morale d'un pur artiste américain devient chose redoutable. Au plus assuré de lui-même, il faut infiniment de courage et de santé d'esprit pour échapper toujours à l'oppression du doute, à la désaffection secrète, à l'anxiété même, qui peut conduire l'homme à une véritable dépossession de soi. This, I think, is what comes across in MacLeish's poem, American Letter, from which I now quote. This land is my native land, and yet I am sick for home, for the red roofs and the olives, and the foreign words, and the smell of the sea fall. How can a wise man have two countries? How can a man have the earth and the wind, and want a land far off, alien, smelling of palm trees, and the yellow gorse at noon and the long calms? It is a strange thing to be an American. Neither an old house it is, with the air tasting of hung herbs and the sun returning year after year to the same door, and the churn making the same sound in the cool of the kitchen, mother to son's wife, and the place to sit marked in the dust by the worn stone at the wellhead. That are the eyes like each other's eyes, and the skull shaped to the same fault and the hand sameness. Neither a place it is, nor a blood name. America is west and the wind blowing. America is a great word in the snow. Away a white bird, the rain falling. A shining thing in the mind and the gull's call. America is neither a land nor a people. A word shape it is, a wind sweep. America is alone, many together, many of one mouth, of one breath, dressed as one, and none brothers among them. Only the taut speech and the ape tongue. America is alone, and the gulls calling. It is strange to be born of no race and no people. In the old lands, they are many together. They keep the wise cast and the words spoken in common. They remember the dead with their hands, their mouths dumb. They answer each other with two words in their meeting. They live together in small things. They eat the same dish, their drink is the same in their proverbs. Their youth is like. They are like in their ways of love. They are many men. There are always others beside them. Here it is one man and another. And wide on the darkening hills, the faint smoke of the houses. Here it is one man and the wind in the boughs. This is our land. This is our people. This that is neither a land nor a race. We must reap the wind here in the grass for our soul's harvest. Here we must eat our salt or our bones starve. Here we must live or live only as shadows. This is our race, we that have none, that have had neither the old walls nor the voices around us. This is our land, this is our ancient ground, the raw earth, the mixed bloods and the strangers, the different eyes, the wind and the heart's change. These we will not leave, though the old call us. This is our country, earth, our blood, our kind. Here we will live our years till the earth blind us. The wind blows from the east, the leaves fall. Far off in the pines, a jay rises. The wind smells of haze and the wild ripe apples. I think of the mast that sets and the sweet rain. But if in this poem, American Letter, MacLeish shows nostalgia for Europe, for the old world, and he will always retain deep contact with it, he makes fun in other poems of, in one poem in particular of which I'm thinking, poem entitled The Artist as the Artist, the sort of arts for art's sake poet. He makes fun in this poem of an American anti-American, a puny poet, shall we say, who to the deltas and the prairies of America, its wide open geography, prefers countesses, kings and palaces, prefers, if you like, Europe, or shall we say, prefers a phony Europe. This man is given a ridiculous name, Mr. Plouf. He washes his hands of America, tries to forget Natchez, Wounded Knee, the Shenandoah, tries to forget vulgar Tennessee and violent Texas, and moves back, in a phony kind of way, to the Cinquecento. And MacLeish makes fun of him, putting forward as proofs the little poet's opinion that there is more shade for an artist under a fig than under the whole damn range of the bighorns. MacLeish is very much concerned not with the artistic fig, but with the whole damn range of the bighorns. And in other poems, he comes out very strongly for America. For example, in Colloquy for the States, or as in this poem from Frescoes for Mr. Rockefeller City, entitled Landscape as a Nude. And it is a presentation of America as a female figure. Ah, she is beautiful here in the sun where she lies. She is not like the soft girls naked in vineyards, or the soft naked girls of the English islands, where the rain comes in with the surf on an east wind. Hers is the west wind in the sunlight. The west wind is the long, clean wind of the continents, the wind turning with earth. Ah, she is beautiful here in the sun, where she lies. She is not like the soft girls naked in vineyards, of the soft naked girls of the English islands, where the sun comes in with the surf and an east wind. Hers is the west wind and the sunlight. The west wind is the long, clean wind of the continents, the wind turning with earth. Always this west wind, the wind and the west. Paul Claudel, speaking of Saint-Jean-de-Perse, said this: Saint-Jean-de-Perse vient authentiquement de l'ouest, la vraie patrie de tous les hommes de désir. This phrase is even truer of Archibald MacLeish. In one of his essays, The Imagined America, which came out in 1943, he says this of the American continent, of America: the whole history of our continent is a history of the imagination. It was peopled, he says, by minds with imagination, with desire, and with courage. That is Archibald MacLeish's ethos for America. But, and here his critical lucidity comes in, the U.S., in his opinion, had, in some sense, lost America. And by 1949, MacLeish was saying, we lost our way as a people, unable to think. Saying this in 1949, and he's saying that America had hitched itself onto opposition to the USSR. In other words, it had limited its possibilities. And MacLeish says this: we know very well that the real difficulty of our time goes deeper than Russian imperialism or communist fraud. The real difficulty touches life itself, not merely the manipulation of life. It involves a conflict not between nations, but between worlds. A dying world, not altogether dead. A new world, conceived, but not yet born. So the real conflict, where it's really at, where it's really happening, is in a conflict between two worlds. I quote again: a dying world, not altogether dead, a new world, conceived, but not yet born. In other words, for MacLeish, the new world had not yet been realized. The old world meant, let's give a short definition, men fulfilling themselves as members of some closely knit body, a city, or a church. He's thinking of Greek Athens or, say, medieval Europe. Whereas the New World meant that men would have to realize themselves as whole and individual human beings answerable only to their consciousness. What he saw in America, what he wanted for America, was moral action at the highest level. Affirmative recommitment, as he says, and I quote him, to the revolution of the individual, which was the vital and creative impulse of our national life. It's time, he says, for America to regain itself. And in A Time to Speak, one of his essay books, he says that the crisis in American reality, in American being, came from a failure to desire and imagine the world, which is, of course, for him, the poetic thing. Desire and imagine the world. That's one aspect of the crisis. And the other aspect of the crisis was an incapacity to keep up with the events of a changing world. He speaks of some poets who apparently were in tune with the changing world. He says that Apollinaire moved in this direction, Sandrart, Pound, French poets and American poets. They were involved in change, but, he says, MacLeish says, their hearts were still in the other world, in the older world. As for T.S. Eliot's Wasteland, that for MacLeish was a termination, an end point, from which a new beginning had to be made. And it's this new beginning which for MacLeish was, and I quote again, the great labor of our day, the thing being to reoccupy the living world. It's with these ideas in mind that MacLeish speaks out boldly and publicly. Instead of writing what you might call private letters open to the public, he really goes definitely public. Now, the danger of going public is that you might tend to write what we can call platform poetry. Saint John Peirce, again, was very much aware of this danger, and he speaks of it to MacLeish, while recognizing that in his best work, MacLeish avoided that trap of mere platform poetry. In a letter to MacLeish, dated 12th November 1948, Saint John Peirce says this: Votre art, et quelque autre grâce du ciel, ont eu raison de mes préventions toujours très fortes contre les grands thèmes d'actualité ou de moralité publique et politique. Du fait sans doute de cette source humaine, de cette source initiale que vous avez su garder profondément en vous, l'homme et l'artiste vont de pair dans votre démarche poétique. Et la voix qui s'élève là est une voix qui vous est propre. Pudeur et maîtrise ne sont-elles pas plus hautes que l'orgueil? Allez sur votre seuil et respirez librement, mon cher ami. Je ne pense pas seulement à l'épanouissement de votre grand poème, dont la réussite était une gageure. Je vous ai déjà dit combien j'aimais la pure modulation, le libre cours et la naissance sans parole de quelques-uns de vos petits poèmes lyriques, les plus élusives, les plus sensibles de vos dernières notations musicales, réduites à l'essentiel et pourtant riches de bonheur tactile, m'ont enchanté par leur refus de toute matière intellectuelle. J'aimerais enfin vous dire, plus particulièrement, combien j'ai été intéressé et ravi par votre façon de traiter le thème intellectuel dans des poèmes en laisse ou verset. Il y a là toute la revanche de l'intelligence sensible quand elle s'allie encore un peu de magie pour s'éclairer elle-même à la frontière de l'insaisissable. I'll repeat the last phrase, seems to be important. Il y a là toute la revanche de l'intelligence sensible, of which we spoke before, quand elle s'allie encore un peu de magie pour s'éclairer elle-même à la frontière de l'insaisissable. À la frontière de l'insaisissable. We'll come to that frontier later on. MacLeish is concerned then with the American adventure, shall we say, with a reappraisal of, a reappropriation of the American adventure. It comes across in many poems, for example, in this one on the Indian Crazy Horse. When Crazy Horse was there by the Black Hills, his heart would be big with the love he had for that country, and how it went out from you, wide and clean in the sunset. But his most sustained effort in this direction was the long poem Conquistador. In this long poem Conquistador, he follows more or less the account given by Bernal Diaz del Castillo in his True History of the Conquest of New Spain, but he alters and transposes what he thinks fit and necessary. As to the topography of this poem, it came to him from a march he made from the seacoast to the Valley of Mexico in 1929. So it was based on his own experience of the route by foot and muleback in the winter of that year, 1929. Here is a section from Conquistador. In fact, it's the final section, the 15th book. And we marched against them there in the next spring. And we did the thing that time by the books and the signs. And we burned the back towns and we cut the mulberries. And their dikes were down and the pipes of their fountains dry. And we laid them a Christian siege with the sun and the vultures. And they kept us 93 days till they died of it. And the whole action well conceived and conducted. And they cared nothing for sieges on their side. And the place stank to God and their dung was such as thin swine will pass for the winter flies. And the whole city was grubbed for the roots, and their guts were swollen with tree bark. And we let them go, and they crawled out by the soiled walls and the rubbish. 3 days they were there, and the dikes going, and the captain's ill of the bad smell of that city, and the town gone, no stone to a stone of it. And the whole thing was a very beautiful victory. And we squared the streets like a city in old Spain, And we built barracks and shops and the church conspicuous. And those that had jeered at our use, but the fashion changes, they came like nettles and rye slash like beetles. They ran on a new land like lice staining it. They parceled the bloody meadows their late feet stood in the passes of harsh pain and of winter. And the stale of the campments they called herbs. They peeled the twigs of the birch and they stood at the hill fights thinking. They brought carts with their rogue beds and their boards and the pots they had and the stale clothes and the stink of stewed grease in the gear and their wives before them, sour and smelling of spent milk and their children. They built their barns like the old coats under Cordova. They raised the Spanish cities, the new hills, showed as the old with the old walls and a tether of gold goats and a dung and the rock hidden. Old, an old man sickened and near death. And the west is gone now. The west is the ocean sky. O day that brings the earth back, bring again that well-swept town, those towers and that island. So he goes back into the history of the conquest of America, showing the horrors, showing a love of this land, and showing at the same time what had happened to it. This old man contemplating what had happened, old, an old man sickened and near death, and the west is gone now, the west is the ocean sky. O day that brings the earth back, bring again that well-swept town, those towers, and that island. Always the obsession with the west is gone now, the west is the ocean sky. As if America had always been a desire for that west and had very often destroyed the very possibility at its birth moment. The west, the limits of the west, the frontier. Frederick Jackson Turner's hypothesis is well enough known. His idea is that the frontier was the essential factor of Americanization and the central fact in American culture. The last frontier, in any material sense of the word, was the Great Plains. The Great Plains, say roughly between 1865, the end of the Civil War, and 1890. By that time, you had the Cheyenne, the Arapaho, and the Sioux making a last stand, or shall we say, making a last attempt at the nomad life, at nomadism, before the incoming force of the railroads. Let's make a list of what was happening on the Great Plains. The railroads, the cattle drivers, the ranches, and the barbed wire. So that by the beginning of the 20th century, when Archibald MacLeish, notably, is beginning to think and write, the United States was facing, for the first time in its history, an expansionless existence. There were no more frontiers. There was no more escaping. There was no more lighting out to the territory, as Huckleberry Finn did. Of course, there has been since then talk of new frontiers with capital letters in terms, for example, of outer space, but I think such new frontiers can hardly excite any live mind. The only frontier I think that can excite a live mind nowadays is what I like to call the intellectual frontier. The material frontier has gone, remains now an intellectual, poetical frontier. In an essay of 1955, entitled The Pioneering Spirit, MacLeish gives his notions of frontierdom, frontiering in America. Because the movement of discoverers and conquerors and colonists was a movement from east to west across the Atlantic, And because the frontiersmen and the settlers moved across the continent from east to west, west has always been a direction of the future in American history. The American dream has been a dream of the West, of the world further on. But now that the great journey across the ocean and the continent has come to the coast of the Pacific, there are those who say we have come to the end of the dream also. We must look backward now, they say, not forward. We must fear, not hope. We must hate, not love. We must conform, not imagine. It is a strange doctrine to hear from Americans. No man can come to the Pacific coast of this continent and feel he has come to the end of anything. California, it is quite true, has filled up with people. Her valleys are richly farmed. Her cities are among the greatest in the world. Her industries are fabulous. But even so, the American journey has not ended. America is never accomplished. America is always still to build. For men, as long as they are truly men, will dream of man's fulfillment. West is a country in the mind, and so eternal. West is a country in the mind, and so eternal. Let's look at this frontier thing from the point of view of poetics. In his book, Riders on the Earth, referring to Kazantzaki, the Greek poet's report on El Greco, MacLeish says this: a true book is a report upon the mystery of existence. It interprets the signs, brings word back from the frontiers, from the distances. A true book is a report upon the mystery of existence. It interprets the signs, brings word back from the frontiers, from the distances. A poem, then, is bringing word back from the frontiers. And for MacLeish, the prime poets, the principal poets of our time, whether they be Yeats, Rilke, Eliot, Pound, had been engaged on a voyage of discovery beyond human generations into, towards an eternal land. Eliot has some beautiful phrases concerning this frontier thing. In a talk on Dante, for example, in 1950, he says this: the explorer beyond the frontiers of ordinary consciousness — that, I think, is the frontier we're concerned with — the explorer beyond the frontiers of ordinary consciousness will only be able to return and report to his fellow citizens if he has all the time a firm grasp upon the realities in which they are already acquainted. So we're not concerned with any kind of vapid mysticism, but with a move forward and out based on a solid foundation in reality. The explorer beyond the frontiers of ordinary consciousness will only be able to return and report to his fellow citizens if he has all the time a firm grasp upon the realities with which they are already acquainted. Well, MacLeish had, I think, that firm grasp. Remember, he was concerned at one time with the office of facts and figures in a political administration. But his desire, his move, his thrust had always been to go further out, beyond the facts and the figures, towards that frontier, towards that furthest line. In a book whose title I mentioned in the bio-bibliographical run-through, New Found Land, which came out in 1930, he has a poem entitled Land's End. And the first part of this poem is called Geography of This Time. It begins: the peninsulas are held by an ancient people, and races skillful in iron, makers of amulets, keep the sea isles. The situation described here at Land's End is an extremely difficult one. All you hear at this limit, at this Land's End, all you hear are ghostly sea voices. All you see is unreal shapes. This is the geography, the far-out geography of Our Time. And this title, Geography of This Time, MacLeish comes back to it in a book which appeared almost 20 years later in 1948, which is to say how important this theme was for him. He comes back to it in 1948 in Act 5 and Other Poems, Geography of This Time. And he says this: what is required of us is a recognition of the frontiers between the countries, and to take heart to cross over the frontiers. And in the second poem in this book, Act 5, he gives a definition of the frontiers. He says this: first there is the wind, but not like the familiar wind. When the air has this taste of time, cold, bitter, sharp, the frontiers are not far from us. He speaks also at these frontiers of the distortion of images, the inarticulate meanings of the dreams. And finally, another aspect of the frontier, there's the evasion of those with whom we have come. It is at the frontiers that the companions desert us, that the girl returns to the old country, and that we are alone. A situation then of solitude and of exploration. There are many, he says, who came to the frontiers between the times and did not know them. What is required of us is a recognition, but a recognition in this difficult situation with no sign, with no word, with the roads raveled out into ruts and the ruts into dust and the dust stirred by the wind. The roads from behind us ending in the dust. What is required of us is the recognition of the frontiers where the roads end. The frontiers where the roads end. No man's land, a kind of no man's land in which these radical poetic explorations are taking place. And it's this, I think, that comes across in the poem Voyage West. There was a time for discoveries, for the headlands looming above in the first light, and the surf and the crying of gulls, for the curve of the north into secrecy. That time is past. The last lands have been peopled. The oceans are known now. Signora, once the maps have all been made, a man were better dead than find new continents. A man would better never have been born than find upon the ocean new flowers drifted from islands where there are no islands, or midnight out of sight of any land, smell in the altering air for odor of rosemary. No fortune passes that misfortune. To lift along the evening of the sky, certain as sun and sea, a new found land, steep from an ocean where no landfall can be. After that first reading, just to give a sense of the poem, I'd like to read it again with the idea that we may penetrate further into it. Voyage West. There was a time for discoveries, for the headlands looming above in the first light, and the surf and the crying of gulls, for the curve of the coast north into secrecy. That time is past. The last lands have been peopled. The oceans are known now. Signora, once the maps have all been made, a man were better dead than find new continents. A man would better never have been born and find upon the open ocean flowers drifted from islands where there are no islands, or midnight out of sight of any land, smell on the altering air the odor of rosemary. No fortune passes that misfortune. To lift along the evening of the sky, certain as sun and sea, a new found land, steep from an ocean where no landfall can be. What we're concerned with then in Archibald MacLeish is this exploration of a newfound land, the new world, which still remains to be realized in all its potentiality, in all its beautiful reality.